This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Martin Luther King Jr. has become a symbol of the civil rights movement. His portrait is often displayed along those of presidents and religious figures, and for many, his image evokes an ongoing fight for racial equality. But his image also spurs controversy. Not everyone agrees how to use it, and more broadly, whether or not MLK Jr. should be considered the civil rights icon. These topics are going to be part of a panel discussion at the Durham County Library tonight that looks at the power of the image in a post-print world. And I'm joined now by two of tonight's panelists. Joe Winters is a professor of religious studies at Duke University. Joe, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bill Fick is also with us. He's a printmaker and director of the creative art studio Supergraphic and Super G Print Lab in Durham. Bill, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us how this whole idea came about. You were actually thinking about distributing prints of MLK, right?
Right, yeah. The idea came about because I'm a printmaker and I'm interested in the distribution of images and prints. And I wanted just to print a bunch of images of MLK to celebrate because it's the time that we celebrate him. And I wanted to distribute them, see what that would be like. And so I approached Carter Q over at the library. And Carter came up with the idea of us doing a demonstration at the library and also having a panel discussion. So really it was this very simple idea of like, hey, let's make images of Dr. King and distribute them and see how that goes and see what people think about it.
And what did you discover along the way as you pursued
this? We haven't done it yet. I mean, what's been interesting is first of all, finding images of Dr. King you can use because a lot of them are copyright protected. And I did find one. The Library of Congress has lots of images that you can use. So I did find one that I felt was appropriate and was really nice. And so it's been that part of it was kind of interesting, just finding an image that could be used to be printed and distributed. So.
Well, therein lies so one of the interesting kernels that will be, I'm sure, part of this conversation. You were looking for a print that you thought would be appropriate, which means you had some vision of how Martin Luther King should look and be represented, right?
Right, yeah. And actually, basically, I just wanted something that showed him very clearly. There are lots of images of him with other people, but I wanted just an image of him. And really, to compose the image was, his head, and if it was body was there, that was fine too. But really, I wanted to have just a nice photograph of him. And again, researching this, it wasn't that easy to find. Well, once I found the Library of Congress image, it was easy to work with that. But until then, I couldn't find. There were some very iconic images that are out there, but they're protected, and so I couldn't use those.
But let's talk about that, Joe Winters, because that's interesting. If you talk about an iconic image, that means, to some extent, that's the picture that strikes at the core of our understanding of this guy, which becomes a kind of a crazy dynamic in some ways, right? It reinforces a particular vision, and they're flat. These images are flat, and of course, Dr. King was a full human being, right?
Right. No, definitely. I think just thinking about the way in which the term icon can have different meanings, right? So we can think about icon as somebody who's exemplary, right? Represents certain kinds of ideals and values and virtues. And the other way the icon can, right, we think about traditionally or theological religious sense, right? Icon is a representation of some sacred figure, right? And so it's interesting how, to some extent, since the 60s, King has become a kind of iconic figure in both senses to some degree, right?
Well, and what's fascinating is the extent to which the image creates the iconic impression. I mean, that if we keep seeing that picture often enough, I mean, maybe this is what Andy Warhol did for us with Marilyn, right? If you see it often enough, then that becomes who they are, and the character that's conveyed in that person or in that image becomes how we think about the person.
Definitely, especially for most of us who never saw saw King, right? So our understanding of him is through the stories that have been told and the pictures and images that have been circulated, right? And I think, as you said. If you're getting a certain right, if you're only getting a certain image of King, right, always leading a march or a demonstration, speaking in front of a lectern, right, then maybe some of those other kind of complexities, right, or even when he's with other people, if the focus is always on him, you might not see that. Well, other people were also part of this movement, and he was made by these other traditions and institutions, and so forth.
And you say there's actually a kind of a generational divide on on the perceptions of King, right?
Well. I would suggest that if you look at, let's say, certain moments in popular culture, right, would suggest potentially there's some divide. I would say one place for me, I would say, is the hip hop generation, right? In the late 80s, early 90s, it seemed at times Malcolm X's image, right, was either competing with King's image as maybe an alternative political mm-hmm. vision. So one example for me would be the hip-hop group Public Enemy, right? They had their song Fight the Power, right? If you look at the longer version of that, 7-minute version, it begins with images of the March on Washington mm-hmm. in 63, right, for jobs and freedom. You see images of King, you see images of other leaders, right? And right after that, right, it cuts to Chuck D saying, no, "We're not doing that anymore, right? We're not marching, right?" And then you see in the background Malcolm X's image, right?
Yeah.
So there's a sense in which he's saying, not necessarily dismissing King, but saying maybe we're replacing King with an alternative sense of what political struggle is going
to
be.
But right? It's interesting that he has yeah. to start with that image. I mean, let's right. hear that. Yeah, I think you've right. described the mm-hmm. what we'd see very well. Let's hear a little bit of that now.
Just 100 years after Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation that freed the slaves, 200,000 people converge on the nation's capital to rally for civil rights. They come by train, they come by bus and by air. They come from the north, the south, the east and west. They come united in one cause, to urge Congress to pass a civil rights bill to end forever the blight of racial inequity. Washington, D.C., 1963, democracy speaks in a mighty voice.
Check this out, man. We rolling this way. That march in 1963, that was a bit of nonsense. We ain't rolling like that no more. Matter of fact, the young black America, we rolling up with seminars, press conferences, and straight up rallies. Am I right? We gonna get what we got to get. Coming to us. Word up. We ain't going out like that 63 nonsense.
That's a clip from Public Enemy, the music video of the song Fight the Power. And we're talking with religious studies professor Joe Winters at the moment about that. I mean, it's interesting that you have to, that the icon is so powerful that you have to start with the memory right. and then right. overturn right. it.
And then what was also interesting to me was that in the actual video, you have children who are talking about a voting registration drive, right, as if that wasn't part of right Martin Luther King's political vision, mm-hmm. right? So part of it potentially is that potentially a certain image of, let's say, the civil rights movement has been potentially, like you said, flattened, right, yeah. as if a voting drive wasn't also a part of these protests, these demonstrations, these marches, and so forth, right?
Well, yeah. and successful. But again, you're reflecting the emotion of the moment, how mm-hmm. you see this vision. Mm-hmm. And Bill, one of the things you're also thinking about is these images in a post-print world and mm-hmm, kind of how mm-hmm. they morph and change
right.
and how we all now have access to them.
Right.
And they become a means of personal expression for us.
Right, right. And, you know, I think, again, you know, I chose this image because, well, first of all, it's like one of the few that I could actually work with. And then, but like we were talking about earlier is how, you know, nowadays it's like an image like that could be morphed into all kinds of different things. And, you know, it could, and depending on who wanted to use it and how they wanted to use it. So the appropriation of an image and then the refiguring it and then the reorganizing it or mashing it up or
yeah.
whatever has become such a big part of our culture.
I mean, you reflected on the Hope poster. The
Right, exactly. Right. So that was, you know, that's, I would say, what is a great example of a very powerful image that we've familiar with, you know, recently. And just the way that was, you know, taken out of a photograph of Obama at a press conference with George Clooney. And then, and I don't know the specifics of that, but anyway, and then Shepard Fairey took that image
right.
and refigured it, made it into his own image and put Hope at the bottom and, you know, added color and really, and it was a very powerful, a bold image. So, yeah, it's, and that's the thing about our times is that, you know, when the image that I'm going to be printing was done back in the 60s, those were just a few images. That was just the image, and it wouldn't be morphed. Nowadays, it's like you could take that image, and it could be changed into all kinds of different things.
Right, and if you think about the dynamics of this, I mean, if you talk about Hope, that's really a kind of a personal expression. One individual sort of artistically plays with mm-hmm. a photograph, a real artifact, but it goes viral for some reason or another. How that imagination captures the imagination of many, and it becomes all of our vision of sort of who this person is. And then it begins to stand for something much deeper. This message of hope then suddenly is visible to us all.
Yeah, and if I could just jump in about the idea about the viral, I mean, I'm actually doing some old school viral here, where it's actually a tangible printed object that goes that I'm printing as many as possible in about 6 hours. and as many people want to take it, and it's for free, and they can. So it's sort of a this idea going back to an older time when something was printed as opposed to a digital image that can go viral and go to millions of people. Here I'm just in Durham printing, and hopefully it'll go viral amongst maybe 50 or 60 people.
Depending on how much money you have left over to take to Kinko's.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Could even go to 150.
There
who
you
knows?
Go. Right.
But it also talks about change. I mean, in the post-digital world, things change and things are in our, you know, in our view and then out very quickly. But the image of Dr. King has become sacred, Joe. And you talk about the way in which it really has taken its place among he has taken his place among the saints, both in terms in our minds and visually.
No, certainly. I think one way that you realize that it has become sacred is when somebody actually tries to do a kind of irreverent representation, right? And the kind of flack that they get from that and the kind of critique that they get from that. So one example might be Aaron Magruder's kind of cartoon animated depiction in his episode from the Boondocks, King's Return, right? So I won't go too much into it, but he basically, one of the characters has a dream that, playing on the notion
Wait,
of dream.
Wait, well, we actually have a clip.
Oh,
we can,
okay.
we can
oh,
set
great,
that up
great.
And then we'll
okay,
talk a little
great.
Bit more. But I think it gets to what you're talking about. Let's listen.
Then, on October 15th, during an appearance on Politically Incorrect, King shot
the
country.
Great. Dr. King, okay, you're an advocate of nonviolence, but guess what? How do you think the United States should respond to the terror attacks of 9/11?
Well, as a Christian, we are taught that you should love thy enemy, and if attacked, you should turn the other cheek. What?
America was outraged.
The president was very concerned by some comments made by some ex-civil rights leaders, and those people in question should watch their mouths.
Of course, an Al-Qaeda lover like Martin Luther King wants us to just roll over and let the terrorists win because he hates America. My suggestion, go take another 30-year nap, commie bastard.
That's a clip from an episode of the show Boondocks called The Return of King, and I'm talking about that with religious professor, or Duke religion professor Joe Winters. That was not widely well-received in all quarters,
no,
was it?
Definitely. So it's a couple of things. One thing that's interesting about this, right, so you said earlier that there's something when certain people become these sacred icons or national icons, the complexity gets flattened, but also potentially, you know, the subversive, right, quality of their politics, right, gets flattened. And here we see where potentially King's political vision would clash with, right, a kind of, let's say, call it imperial or kind of war strategy here, right? But yeah, so there were many people who were very upset. I think Al Sharpton was one who said, I mean, he was really concerned, I think, about, you know, he had King using the N-word, right, and these kinds of things. We had King at a party, right? And so there was a sense in which he was being irreverent and somehow, you know, violating the sacred quality, right, of King in some way. So, right, that's
well. He also took a shot at political preachers
in that same episode.
So could have taken on
that too.
But it's always so ironic that when the message of these individuals is subversion, it is revolutionary, and then when you are a guy like Aaron Magruder, who is famously iconoclast and subversive, you just don't like him using the image in precisely the way that I think. Well, I shouldn't say what King might have wanted, certainly a big part of his message was overturn the existing order, and so what do you in the process of this, as you think about Bill, the use of images and their impact on our imagination, the way we see people. I mean, what are some of the reflections that you have?
Well, for me, it's really, I mean, it's boils down to something very simple. It's like, you know, for me, it's just the image getting out into the public and then the public interpreting it the way they want to interpret it. And like in this case, it's a very simple, innocuous image. You know, it's a straightforward image of him. But, you know, as we've been talking here, things start to happen. So like for someone who's 18 years old, this image will have a very different meaning than it is for a person who's in their 70s, you know. And so for me, it really just boils down to how images, just when they get into the public, you know, how they're seen and interpreted. And as a printmaker, someone who makes imagery that's bold and graphic and, you know, and it can be distributed in a mass way, then, you know, it's this vehicle for finding out more about how people can see things. And
you wonder, too, about it living in a global world now where we can send these images – across the world to people who didn't know him at all or knew him in a different way. I mean, you think about the fights that people have had within their group, whatever it is, over the way the image should be represented. That's always been within the religion or within the nation. But now the idea of a whole world looking at the image all at once and having their own interpretations, how does that complicate this whole picture of iconography?
Yeah, I would say it complicates how we think about, sacred and profane, right, to some extent, right? Because typically, traditional notions of the sacred assume a kind of distance, right? They assume a kind of distance. They assume, typically the notion of the sacred has been somewhat incompatible with a kind of democratizing, right?
Sure.
So you have this kind of circulation, right? Where not only that you have circulation of these images, but you said you can crop, right? You can place, or you can go to Google Images, and you can see, figures of King wearing, present day dress, right? So the distance and the kind of almost sacred like quality is somewhat undermined, right? For some people that's a good thing. For some people that's a good thing, right?
See this in Islam and in Mosaic law proscriptions against making any kind of graven image at all, because that is other, and there's no material representation at all.
Exactly.
To do so would profanate. And then our problem is, well, the heroes among us are very much among us. So how do we manage and appropriate the message of a very human, palpable, and dynamic figure, but also treat it with some kind of reverence and respect.
It's another thing that I'm very interested in is, and if we think about Andy Warhol's Marilyn, that was a still of Marilyn from a movie, and then Warhol took that image. And then he changed it, many ways. It exists in many colors and there's multiples. And then what's interesting is it's a print on canvas. However, now those prints are selling for $45 million. So it takes on this whole other, where the icon becomes this very expensive work of art, and then living only in certain places, So.
And he's showing us, on the one hand, there is variation, but it ends up being the same thing. And
right.
So there's kind of this monotony and public relations kind of big lie aspect to telling the same story over and over, but it's not the same.
He's got
those things embedded. So what do you hope will happen to come out of all of this?
I actually really don't know. It was the idea again is like, okay, if I print these these prints, get them out there. And again, I'm not expecting, they're not going to be going out all over the place just because it's in one location and whoever comes will be the... So really, I'm just curious to see what happens. It's a bit of an experiment let's see what happens.
And Joe, this could be controversial. This could even be uncomfortable.
That's one thing. I've certainly shown clips of the Boondock Show. Yeah. I've shown that in class, but it was a different kind of setting, right? To be part of this, talk tonight, and to be part, Martin Luther King Day.
You might have the generational divide.
Right.
In
yeah, you
that
might have the generational divide. Right.
What about MLK Day in general? I know there's some dispute about that the idea that not only the holiday, but sometimes February is Black History Month. Mm-hmm. That it is on the one hand a celebration, on the other hand a way of flattening out what is a very complex history.
Yeah, I've been part of conversations with students, both high school students and college students. I was on a panel last year, actually, at UNC Charlotte, where I was before. And I was on a panel, and people was like, why do we still have, right? But the question was kind of like, why still, right, Black History Month, right? Does it still have the same kind of function that someone like Carter G. Woodson wanted it to have?
Right.
And I think the overall sentiment is we need something like it, but that it often flattens the complexities, right? Working with high school students, they also had a sense that we learn about the same people all the time, every February, right? It's kind of like a check. It's like a routine thing, and they wanted to learn more about the different kinds of struggles worldwide, right, that influenced the Black freedom struggle. So,
well, within that Boondocks episode, the idea of provoking a fight was very much what Aaron Magruder had in mind artistically within the thing, and I'm sure as an artist outside, and I think maybe just keeping the fight going is the best way to keep the memory alive.
No doubt, yeah.
Definitely. Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program. Joe Winter is a religious studies professor at Duke University. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Bill Fick is a printmaker and director of the creative art studio Super Graphic and Super G Print Lab in Durham. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
They're going to be at a panel together tonight in Durham at the Durham County Library, 7 o'clock. It's called From Icon to Iconography to Icon Graphic, Martin Luther King Jr. in a Post-Print World. You can find out more about it at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we preview a film festival that looks at the meaning of freedom. Stay with us.